This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. We're continuing our coverage of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina today. In a few minutes, we'll hear the latest news on the ground and from around the country. In New Orleans, recovery crews have begun the grim task of bringing out the dead, while some of the living still refuse to leave. And in cities from Houston to Washington, D.C., shelters continue to swell with the tide of evacuees. Today, we want to hear from Gulf Coast residents displaced by the storm and those taking them in. Give us a call with your story at 800-989-8255. President Bush is on his second tour of the storm-devastated region today, making stops in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Poplarville, Mississippi. Before leaving Washington this morning, the president attended to another issue of national importance. He announced the nomination of John Roberts to the post of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Roberts was supposed to begin hearings for the post of Associate Justice tomorrow, but today the Senate announced it will postpone those hearings to sometime later this week or early next week. We start out today with a look at how Roberts' promotion before even getting the job may change the balance of the court, and how both sides of the political aisle, which spent much of the summer fixing their positions on Roberts as an Associate Justice, are adapting to the news. What are your questions about Roberts' new nomination? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We're joined now from the Time Warner Center in New York City by New Yorker writer and CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Hi, Lynn.
So how much of a surprise was this announcement this morning?
I wouldn't say it's a big surprise. John Roberts has, over the past several months, as the nation's gotten to know him, has emerged as a serious conservative, not a moderate, and someone who is extremely likely to be confirmed. Those two qualifications serve him well as Chief Justice nominee, as well as an Associate Justice nominee, and President Bush, you know, made the change.
Now, the hearing on the nomination of Judge Roberts, the hearing is postponed. Is that out of respect for the late Chief Justice, or do the senators really have to rethink their questioning now?
I think it's a combination of things. It has to do with the funeral for the Chief Justice being on Wednesday, which was the day on which John Roberts was scheduled to get the bulk of his questioning, and I think the juxtaposition would have been kind of inappropriate. Also, you have the hurricane dominating the news. But the Republicans in the Senate and the president want to get this nomination through fast. They want him on the bench by the first Monday in October. So I don't think, certainly the Republicans who are running the show, think that the inquiry called for a Chief Justice nominee is all that different from an Associate Justice nominee process.
Well, is the inquiry going to be different? And I mean, how will it be different?
I think the senators will ask him some more questions, but the responsibilities of the Chief Justice don't lend themselves to very much different questioning than an Associate Justice would. You know, for example, the main power of a Chief Justice is to assign opinions when he's in the majority. He gets to pick which justice writes the opinion. That's not something that calls for a lot of questioning. It is true that the Chief Justice gets to select which lower court judges serve on certain special courts like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which calls into question a nominee's attitude towards national security and issues of that kind, but it's such a level of abstraction that's not likely to call for much more questioning. Frankly, I don't think there is much difference between the kind of questioning that's called for. So it seems sensible that the hearings would proceed.
I'm just wondering symbolically how important it is. I mean, in the public's mind, it seems like a more important position, I think. And I'm wondering just in terms of both sides, both proponents and opponents, how important it is that he is now the nominee for Supreme Court Justice in a symbolic and, I guess, political sense.
Well, symbolically, it is different. You know, the title is, a lot of people make this mistake, and Lynn, I'm afraid you made the mistake too. The title is not Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The title, according to law, is Chief Justice of the United States.
Right.
And that is an example of the symbolism that goes with the job, and people have a certain reverence for that. But I think the country, frankly, is so preoccupied with the hurricane and everything else that whether the hearings start on Thursday or Monday or the following Monday isn't going to have a big political impact one way or another.
Well, will Katrina and its aftermath and the fact that the country's attention is so incredibly focused on that have some effect on the way these hearings proceed as well?
Well, I think that they have an effect on the result. I mean, I think John Roberts was headed for confirmation before the hurricane, but now he is definitely headed for confirmation because, it would take a real groundswell of public opposition to get 40 Democrats to mount a filibuster or 50-plus senators to vote against him. And that groundswell is clearly not there at this point, and with the hearings likely to get less attention while they're still searching for bodies in New Orleans, I just don't see any way, unless John Roberts decides to call for a repeal of the Bill of Rights in his confirmation hearings, that serious opposition to him can be mounted.
Jeffrey Toobin, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker and senior legal analyst at CNN. We have a caller from Chris. I believe he's calling from California. Chris?
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Lynn. My question briefly is, what laws or what governs the president's actions in terms of being able to nominate someone directly to Chief Justice who wasn't previously sitting on the Supreme Court?
Well, the law is no different relating to how what the prior job of the nominee is. You know, there have been 16 chief justices, and about half of them have come from the court, and about half of them have come from other jobs. I mean, to think of the last three, Chief Justice Rehnquist was promoted from an associate justice position. Warren Burger was on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the same court that John Roberts is on. Earl Warren was governor of California. So there is no absolute pattern with regard to what the prior job has to be. It's purely a political choice on the part of the president, and the nomination process is the same regardless of the previous position of the nominee.
Okay. Is there any historical precedent for the political wisdom of pulling someone not sitting on the court versus somebody sitting on the court in terms of how it plays out with the court members and how they interact?
Well, that's a subject that Supreme Court historians have written a lot about. You know, some people think the justices would resent an outsider coming in to be the first among equals. Others think that it messes with the equilibrium of the court to suddenly take one of the associates and make him or her chief. I think, based on my study, that a lot more depends on the individuals involved than any sort of pattern. John Roberts has a real advantage going in, is that he's very much an insider, a former law clerk on the court. Worked in the Solicitor General's office, which is sometimes called the 10th Justice. Argued 39 times before the court. I have a piece in the current issue of the New Yorker about Justice Kennedy, and Justice Kennedy said to me that John Roberts was a marvelous oral advocate, and we feel like we know him. So I think he will go into the court with a lot of goodwill on the part of the justices, and even though he is an outsider, he's kind of an insidery outsider.
All right, thanks very much for your call, Chris. Let's see if we can get one more call here from Rob, and he's calling from Idaho. Hi, Rob.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I was wondering how somebody like Scalia would get along with somebody like Roberts. I could see Scalia throwing a hissy fit that he wasn't nominated.
I doubt Justice Scalia really harbored any serious hopes of being nominated. Justice Scalia is 68 years old. This administration has made it very clear that they are interested in a long-term impact on the courts. And John Roberts at 50 is certainly in a position to influence the court longer than Scalia would be appointed at 68. One of the hallmarks of Justice Scalia's career has been a willingness to alienate people and write dismissive, sarcastic opinions criticizing his colleagues. So I don't think his nose will be out of joint. He actually even made a joke to the Chief Justice's clerks who gathered for their reunion this year about how he was campaigning to be Chief Justice. I don't think he would have made that joke if he was seriously campaigning to be Chief Justice. I think he's happy where he is.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Rob.
Thank you.
Now, John Roberts was originally meant to replace Justice Sandra O'Connor. She has confirmed that she's going to stay on until her replacement is found?
That's right.
And what about replacing Sandra Day O'Connor? What do you think the president will be looking for in this next pick for the
Supreme
Court?
Well, Lynn, I think this is really remains the key choice on the court because, you know, the Roberts for Rehnquist change in the court probably won't affect the results of the court very much one way or another. Chief Justice Rehnquist, very conservative. Roberts likely to be conservative himself. O'Connor was a much more unpredictable vote, and I think this is where the change in the decisions could come about. The interesting question here is, will President Bush go back to the same short list he consulted just 5 weeks ago? Well, he probably will. I mean, nothing much has changed in 5 weeks. Or will he look for someone else? Given the president's apparently weakened political condition, will he go for a less provocative choice? Will he avoid judges like Michael Luttig and Priscilla Owen, who are perceived as being very conservative, and go towards Alberto Gonzalez or Harvey Wilkinson, who are considered to be somewhat more moderate? Will he be more likely to look for a woman or a Hispanic or a black justice? You know, I don't know for sure. My experience with President Bush is he always picks the more conservative choice, and he's not afraid of a fight.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jeffrey.
Okay, Lynn.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a CNN legal analyst. When we come back from a short break, we'll look back on the week since Hurricane Katrina made landfall. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary. President Bush is back in Louisiana and Mississippi today, touring hurricane-related damage and the work done to aid the newly homeless. Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff says a major concern for emergency workers now is how to care for the hundreds of thousands of people who've been relocated. In a few minutes, we'll be checking in on those efforts in New Orleans and around the region. Although Hurricane Katrina wreaked most of her damage early last week, this story goes back a bit further. 2 weeks ago today, the National Hurricane Center in Miami issued an advisory on what it called Tropical Depression 12 forming out in the Atlantic. At that point, the blip on a screen didn't even warrant a name. The next day, though, South Florida was warned of Tropical Storm Katrina, which the center believed could intensify into a minimal hurricane. The winds picked up. Katrina evolved into a hurricane, and on August 25th, Katrina went ashore south of Fort Lauderdale. Luis Maurice is a Miami resident.
Kind of creeped up on us, so we weren't expecting such a strong storm without usually the warning that we usually get a couple, 2 or 3 days. They're beating the drums and everybody getting ready, but I guess it's a lesson for all of us to be learned that these storms, you cannot take them lightly because they're very, very unpredictable.
In passing over Florida, Katrina dropped again to a tropical storm. But once over the warm waters of the Gulf, the story changed again. Here's Eric Blake of the National Weather Service on Sunday the 28th.
This is a very dangerous hurricane. It could have catastrophic consequences if it hits at this intensity.
The call for the evacuation of New Orleans and other Gulf Coast cities went out. Last Monday, as Katrina slammed into southern Louisiana, then into southern Mississippi and Alabama, reports of extensive damage washed in. But they came with initial sense of relief. Despite the dire predictions, New Orleans stood mostly unscathed. NPR's John Burnett.
They dodged the bullet, but they still got a sound bruising. There is the famed levee, the 130-mile levee that surrounds the city of New Orleans, has been breached by this storm in a couple of places. One would be the Lower Ninth Ward, the Jackson Barracks, which they're very concerned about. We heard reports of people on rooftops, people trying to batter their way out of attics with axes.
But overnight and into Tuesday, water continued to pour in, and the emergency escalated. 80% of the city was underwater. Hospitals lost power. People who stayed in their homes fled to their roofs or drowned. And for trapped evacuees in the Superdome, conditions deteriorated into misery. As NPR covered the devastation, callers from the region were desperate for information.
My husband's heading down there with his truck and a trailer full of gas and water and canned food, but we haven't been able to get in touch with his mother and sister and cousins that are there.
My grandmother, she lives in a retirement community in Ocean Springs, Mississippi, and my uncle lives down there as well, and apparently she was supposed to be with him during the hurricane. However, he was being very stubborn and was determined to stay home and ride this thing out. She's almost 90 years old, and I just have this vision of her on top of their one-story house with flood waters all around them, and, you know, it's a little scary.
I wish I had better.
And while Coast Guard and other rescue efforts worked to pluck thousands from floodwaters and rooftops, federal, state, and local officials seemed helpless to form a cohesive plan. Frustration mounted. Here are New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin on station WWL, then Jefferson Parish President Aaron Broussard on Meet the Press, and finally President Bush's Saturday radio address.
They don't have a clue what's going on down here. They flew down here one time, 2 days after the doggone event was over, with TV cameras, AP reporters, all kind of excuse my French, everybody in America, but I am pissed.
The guy who runs this building I'm in, emergency management, he's responsible for everything. His mother was trapped in St. Bernard Nursing Home, and every day she called him and said, are you coming, son? Is somebody coming? And she said, yeah, Mama, somebody's coming to get you. Somebody's coming to get you on Tuesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Wednesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Thursday. Somebody's coming to get you on Friday. And she drowned it Friday night.
The magnitude of responding to a crisis over a disaster area that is larger than the size of Great Britain has created tremendous problems that have strained state and local capabilities. The result is that many of our citizens simply are not getting the help they need, especially in New Orleans. And that is unacceptable.
With communication partially restored and evacuations virtually completed, the search for bodies is now underway. In recent hours and days, families have been united and have expanded. Adam Shipley is the music director for Tipitina's, a mainstay New Orleans night spot.
My boss came in with a bus and rescued out all of these people, but also on the way from this rescue, they picked up a pregnant woman right near I-10 as they got to Tipitina's. She went into labor, and he delivered a baby on the Walk of Fame in front of Tipitina.
As we continue to cover the story from the Gulf Coast states, we want to hear from you about your experiences. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totnnpr.org. Even as there are stories of hope and reconnection, difficult and gruesome tasks remain. There is still no official body count, but yesterday Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff said of the recovery effort that it is going to be about as ugly ugly a scene as I think you can imagine. Earlier today, NPR's John Isdy visited the tiny Louisiana town where the storm's body count is scheduled to begin. He's back in Baton Rouge and joins us now. Thanks for being with us, John.
Hi, Lynn.
John, give us a sense of what is happening today and what you yourself have seen today.
Well, up to now, Lynn, the concerted effort has been search and rescue. And even when bodies were found, they'd often be left for retrieval later because they wanted to, the focus was on saving people. And authorities tell us today that within the next 24 hours or so, hopefully beginning today, they will begin a concerted effort to recover bodies. They're going to divide the city into a grid, and they're going to send out teams, including teams from the Louisiana Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Emergency Preparedness, to search for bodies. And then they will bring the bodies to a FEMA morgue in a warehouse in this small Louisiana town, St. Gabriel, which is about 12 miles or so south of Baton Rouge, about 60 miles west of New Orleans. And they will handle the bodies there. This facility should be able to ultimately process about 140 bodies per day. And the first step will be to decontaminate the bodies. There's concern about disease and spreading disease, so initially they'll be contaminated. They'll go through a process where they confirm that the death was a result of the hurricane, not foul play. There'll be dental forensics experts there. There'll be DNA experts there. They'll take samples. They'll look at personal effects, try to identify these people. Actually, they'll take all the information they have, send it to the state of Louisiana, and Louisiana will find records of the people who are lost, try to match these up, and then identify the next of kin.
Who's in charge of this whole process, John?
FEMA is in charge of the morgue. There's a Louisiana official from the Emergency Preparedness Division of the Department of Health and Hospitals who will will be actually running the morgue down there.
Any sense of how many bodies they're expecting to find? Is anybody giving a number at this point to what they think they might find?
Well, you know, Dr. Louis Cataldi, who's the representative of the state of Louisiana, who will be affiliated with the morgue, said he is, you know, he wants to be certain about the count. At this point, we've heard officials talk about the dead will be in the thousands. For him, it's a very specific process. And yesterday, actually, we did get the first official body count from him. 59 people, according to Dr. Cataldi, have been certified as having died as a result of Hurricane Katrina. Obviously, that number is going to rise. Just how high, he doesn't want to speculate. But certainly, people are expecting, many officials have suggested, in the thousands.
All right. John, let's take a call. We are going to go to Stephen. And he's calling us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Stephen.
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
I was in Hattiesburg for 4 days after the storm hit. And just the lack of anything coming down there was amazing. They had cleared off 59, which is the highway coming in, on Tuesday, or late Tuesday, early Wednesday, and there was nothing coming in. I mean, really, me and my friends had saved up enough water for 1 or 2 days, but there was just nothing down there. There's no help from anywhere coming in. Like, I kept seeing trucks come down, but none of them stopped in Hattiesburg, and all radios had been completely cut off except for one station, and they were trying to give people information about where, like, places to pick up food and water and ice were. And people would go to these places only to find out that there was nothing there to pick up. They'd call the radio stations back and tell them that there was that the supplies hadn't come yet. And
Stephen, where are you now and how did you get out? Are you in a shelter or do you have family where you are? Or?
I have family. They didn't know where I was for the first few days because I couldn't call them and all the lines were down. But the fourth day, around midnight, I was able to call and reach my sister, and they got all three of my family members that live in North Carolina got in a car and put about 30 gallons worth of gas in a gas tank and came down here. And they were able to fill up until Birmingham, Alabama, but after that, there's just no gas the rest of the way down. Unfortunately, they had the extra tanks because it was barely enough to get back to Birmingham from where I was.
All right. Thank you very much for calling us, Stephen.
Yes, ma'am.
And good luck. I know you've got a lot of – you got to rebuild now for yourself, so good luck.
Thank you. Could I add one more thing?
Sure.
Thank you, everyone, for the help and the donations that you sent. It's really amazing to see all of America really coming together and helping out down there. I really please keep sending any help you can, and I hope that's it. Thank you, Matt.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. John Ince, did you have a sense on the ground there that things are more organized now? Maybe you can give us a sense of that.
I think certainly things are more organized. I was not in New Orleans yesterday, but the day before I was there, and there were National Guardsmen all over on the streets. Things seem much more organized. The mass evacuation has ended. The effort to get the water out of the city is progressing. The Corps of Engineers said yesterday that they were very pleased with the progress they'd made in getting the levee, 17th Street Canal levee, filled in, and we're beginning to run 24, I think they had 24 pumps going, trying to get the water down and so that they could dry out pump number 6, which is a huge pumping complex in New Orleans. Once they get those that pump dried out and begin pumping the water out, they're hoping they can have it done in a minimum maybe of 35 days or so, 36 days. They say a maximum of 80 days, but it sounds like they're optimistic now that it can be sooner than that. So things seem to be more organized.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Lynn.
NPR reporter John Itzy joined us by phone from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now we turn to Mississippi's recovery efforts. Mississippi is slowly restoring power to parts of the state affected by the hurricane, but there are also growing concerns about water contamination. Stan Tyner is the executive editor of the Biloxi Sun-Herald. He joins us from his office in Biloxi. Thanks so much for being with us, Stan.
Thank you, Lynn.
Can you give us a sense of the situation in Mississippi today? We just had a caller on who was saying that he had been in Hattiesburg and there'd been no help at all. He managed to get out to family in North Carolina, but what's the situation now?
Well, I think there is a growing sense that things are getting better. It took us a while to get to that point, but there is more evidence that that there is. We're a long way from really having a sense that something normal is happening here, because it won't be for a long time. But more gas stations have gas. They have long lines, but more have gas. There's little things like a Waffle House that's opened up somewhere, or a hotel over there. And, you know, there's small victories that we see every day. But I think the interesting thing that I'm hearing from the field today is that there seem to be a lot of private relief efforts that are setting up shop across South Mississippi. That people have just come down and are bringing us stuff from the abundance of their concern across the nation, and it's church groups, private businesses, and people who want to help are showing up, and indeed seem to be helping.
What are the recovery teams focusing on now? What is the biggest area?
Well, Governor Barber was in the Sun-Herald yesterday, and you know, the success in finding a couple of gentlemen in Hancock County on Saturday heartened people to believe that there are still some survivors out there. So we have some very capable search and recovery teams that are there, and that has been the priority all along, and I think has something to do with the fact that the number of deaths seems to be lower than what the expectation is. It's currently 167 in in the lower counties, but many people, or most people, think that the number is likely to be bigger than that. But I believe there's still a serious and aggressive effort to find someone alive, and that's still the priority.
What are people most concerned about in terms of their own needs? Is it housing? Are there health concerns?
Well, I think right now the public health issue is one that's very much front of mind, because we parse the words very carefully when we hear medical teams talk about the possibility that the potential for deaths from disease are quite great unless we're very, very vigilant in trying to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. Just at the news, it got our attention here. So the steps that we're taking just at the newspaper building, and we have a large gathering of Sun Herald and Knight Ridder reporters, but a lot of folks just sort of show up here. So trying to get people to follow the rules of sanitizing your shoes before you walk in. We've got reporters that are literally at every...
Stan, if you can hold on, we're going to take a short break. Sure. Stan Tyner, executive editor of the Biloxi Sun-Herald. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR stations, and from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage, from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most, gatesfoundation.org, and from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org. supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The wave of evacuees from New Orleans and the Gulf Coast is slowly filtering into the rest of the country. 1,000 arriving in Albuquerque, 400 to Washington, D.C., shelters in Georgia, families in Illinois. I'm Lynn Neary. We'll follow the stories of the Katrina diaspora on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. We're discussing the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina today, and we'd like to hear your experiences. If you'd like to give us a call, you can reach us at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And with me still is Stan Tyner. He is the executive editor of the Biloxi Sun-Herald, and he joins us from his office in Biloxi. Stan, I guess I have just one other question for you. Just looking around where you live, where you work, do you have any sense of how long it's going to take for things to return to any semblance of normalcy there?
Well, we talk about that a lot, and as people come here, I just had a conversation with a team of Sun Herald people who we sent before the storm up to Columbus, Georgia, where they have been producing the paper since then, and trucking it in. We published last night, literally the presses of the Sun-Herald published their first paper since the storm last night, so we're now beginning to deal with the human concerns of our staff, the ones who have not been here, and they're listening to you and watching television, but they're coming back to very uncertain conditions, and at least three of them we think may have lost their homes. And so the psychology of where we are and what we are and how our world will be changed for a very long time is something we talk about and try to be attentive to and listening to our employees as everybody else is having to deal with it, not just doing the professional job, but also think about being a parent. We had one of the editors concerned because of the health conditions. His wife is a nurse, and someone had said, you know, you really need to think about bringing your daughter back to this. So there's a certain trepidation that makes it not like before, and we are aware that it's going to be a while before any kind of real normality exists here.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Stan.
Thanks, man.
Stan Tyner is the executive editor of the Biloxi Sun-Herald, and he joined us from his office in Biloxi. We're going to take a call now from Pat in Missouri. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm actually just coming back out of the Mandeville, Slidell, Lacombe area. After going in, I took my family out. I live two blocks off the lakefront in Mandeville, which is, you know, not at all the bullseye of any of the target of the storm.
Wait, can you tell us where that is exactly? Where's Mandeville?
Yeah, it's just across Lake Pontchartrain. It's on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain, and it's my home was, I'd say, three, 4 blocks off the lake. And the lakefront there, of course, all of the restaurants, everything is, you know, the bottom levels are washed out, and, you know, there's a... the storm knocked down an untold amount of trees and power lines. But what occurred to my brother and I when we were back there helping deliver some supplies in a limited manner was that when we had an opportunity to talk to the mayor of Mandeville, who turned us on to the mayor of Slidell, who turned us on to the fire chief, district chief, the police chiefs, you know, we met in a 24-hour period with many city leaders to realize they have no communication with each other. You know, they don't, everybody has all the immediate problems they're dealing with, which are, you know, power outages and other things. They honestly can't tell people what they need. You know, we discovered a shortage of diesel fuel for the fire department and the police department, and across town, an excess of diesel fuel and a shortage of gas.
Now, are you saying they can't communicate because communication lines are down or because...
Yeah.
They're just so overwhelmed.
Communication lines are down, and plus all of them are so busy on so many matters that sometimes the simple matter of finding out that people have resources, also the fact that, you know, the citizens that return are, you know, because they're getting in line, big lines for the gas pumps and stuff like that, the odd shortages of things like 5-gallon gas drums, empty ones, that the police can actually fill up with that are manageable, are in short supply all the way back to Houston, you know. So we've just been sort of collecting there. We created a place where they could call us with external wish lists, and we're calling outside people and saying, you know, we need 50 generators delivered to the mayor of Mandeville. We need stuff. We went by a fire station in Lacombe and gave them a generator. Their shelter has 7 days with people in it, hasn't had a single light bulb in it, you know.
Yeah.
They're feeding people and doing all that, but... You know,
so it's still a matter of sort of, it sounds like it's still a matter of needing somebody to oversee it all, it sounds
well,
like,
right,
or to coordinate things.
More than just one, many, many people
yeah.
to be connected dots people. What to me, you know, listening to your show, it's very appreciative that more information gets out, but I think the low death count, of course, is very deceiving. And the fact that in many of these towns, all the way across through the harder hit areas of Pass Christian, Waveland, Biloxi, it's a sunny day, and maybe some little semblance of they can get bananas now are that things aren't as bad as, I mean, I don't want to sound apocalyptic because there's recovery everywhere you look, but the reports from these people about, you know, they can't get tankers in with gas because of lines of people trying to see their stuff, you know, just there's so many things that are reaching the Mid-South in gas shortages. And
right.
We driving now north to go retrieve my kids and wife. Last night we saw, you know, 20, 30 cars on the roadside that were abandoned after dark that are people who didn't do the math to have enough gas to get any further out.
Right.
You know, this
well, Pat,
is very, you know, the economics, the fact that a quarter of the stuff coming into the ports of New Orleans are not able to get to other places. You know, it's just something that can't be looked at lightly nationally. And I think the thing to do is, you know, we're urging people who outside say, well, I'd like to do something, but I don't know what. They have to use their thinking side to say, do I know a transport company? Do I know a, you know, a celebrity with an airplane? Do I know? I mean, there's just so many ways people can help that they're not aware of.
All right, Pat, thank you so much. I'm going to, I know that our listeners will take that to mind, your advice from somebody who has been there and been watching what's been going on the ground, and that is just thinking of the ways that they can address some of the needs that you've just pointed out, and I really appreciate your calling. Thank you so much.
Very good.
Good. Bye-bye. Residents of Jefferson Parish, Louisiana, which is a suburb of New Orleans, were allowed to return home today for the first time since Hurricane Katrina hit. Houston Chronicle's Roma Khanna was on the scene this morning as evacuees saw what was left of their belongings. She joins us by phone on the road in Louisiana. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Lynn.
Can you tell us, Roma, what did the town look like when you got there?
Well, as you drive in, you know, sort of the initial parts of Jefferson Parish are really quite dry, but as you sort of make your way into a lot of the neighborhoods, we saw a lot of flooding and a ton of wind damage, you know, roofs pulled off and downed, huge trees just downed across the middle of the street. So there's quite a bit of wind damage and quite a bit of flooding, you know, coming into the first floor of many houses.
And were you accompanying people who were going back and looking over what was left of their homes? And what kinds of stories were you hearing? How were people reacting?
We talked to quite a few people who walked into their homes for the first time. And the reactions really ran the gamut. I spoke to one woman who just burst into tears. She walked down, you know, half a mile of railroad tracks to get to her house because the roads were not passable, and looked down the street where her house is on and saw that it was submerged up to a stop sign and just burst into tears and was so upset about all of her sort of mementos and family belongings being lost. Another man who lived actually in the same neighborhood took a paddle boat into, or a row boat into the neighborhood and walked up to his house and found that the water had stopped at his front steps. And he, you know, his home came away unscathed. So the damage throughout Jefferson Parish really varies neighborhood to neighborhood. Some have quite a bit of water. Some are quite dry.
Now, how long can people stay there right now? And are they allowed to take things out? What are the conditions that have been set for people going into Jefferson Parish?
People are allowed to enter the parish between today through Thursday. And they are allowed, if they want to stay here overnight. But there is a 6 p.m. curfew for people who do choose to stay here. If they stay here, of course, they're dealing with no power, you know, plumbing issues and those sorts of things. So many of the people I ran into were going into their homes to simply assess damage, gather some valuables, and make their way back out of the parish immediately. The parish is going to close Thursday night permanently, you know, until recovery efforts are completed.
Yeah. Do you have a sense that people are determined to come back and rebuild, or are they moving on? Are they getting out? Are they leaving permanently?
It's been a whole variety of things. And to be honest, a lot of people are finding that their businesses are relocating either temporarily or possibly more permanently. And that, of course, has a way of pulling people away from towns. Some people were so upset when they walked into their houses, they sort of wished they had never come in, you know, never come to see him to begin with because of the amount of damage. And one woman talked about, you know, deciding that walking in and seeing her house made her decide to move on. Others, of course, say New Orleans and their, you know, Louisiana area is resilient and that people will come back. And but, of course, it will take time, and inevitably there will be a period of time when this area and the areas around New Orleans are really not that populated just because of logistical issues.
All right, Roma, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Roma Khanna is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle, and she joined us by phone from the road in Louisiana. We're going to take a call now from Valerie. She's in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Valerie. Valerie?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, I rode out the storm in Hattiesburg. I was visiting my sister and unfortunately got stuck in the storm. Tried to get out on Sunday, but by that time the evacuation from the coast was in full force, so you could only go north, and then, of course, coming south, only emergency vehicles were allowed through. So we rode out the storm in a cement garage because the constant cracking and falling of trees was very frightening, and many homes in and around the neighborhood where she is have 100-foot pine trees right through the middle of their homes. We were very lucky. We had lots of trees fall down, but nothing hit their house.
And how did you get out?
Well, finally, interestingly enough, Delta Airlines insisted that I could get out of Gulfport on Tuesday and Wednesday, but we decided to take a ride on Thursday to Mobile, and I was able to get out, and it was also good for her because Mobile was the first town that we saw east of Hattiesburg that had any semblance of functioning Thursday morning. The Walmart had just opened, and although there was no meat or milk or some other supplies that she was able to get.
Mallory, I'm glad you're safe. Go ahead.
Last time we were in contact was 2 days ago, and I have been unable to contact her. The only communication they had was cell phone, but that's in and out. It's not a reliable source of communication.
Wait, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. With your sister, are you saying?
Yes, this is my sister and her family, and they're lucky. I can tell you one thing about the state of Mississippi. Most men have chainsaws and trailers and all sorts of, especially if they live in rural areas, which most of the state is. So just the average people were out clearing main roads the very next morning, and that was fortunate because very large trees were blocking every road you could get to.
Well, I'm glad you got out, Valerie. Thanks so much for calling us. Bye-bye. Throughout this disaster, as the water rose and other services cut out, residents of New Orleans had one lifeline still available. A group of radio stations calling themselves the United Broadcasters of New Orleans stayed on the air, providing information and fielding desperate phone calls. A week later, they're still at it. And we're joined now from Baton Rouge by Andy Hult. He's the program director for WTKL and WLMG, part of the United Broadcasters of New Orleans. Thanks so much for being with us. And tell us something about the United coverage.
Well, this is rather unprecedented, Lynn. We have our company, Intercom Communications of New Orleans, has joined forces with our competitors, but also colleagues at Clear Channel of New Orleans. We've relocated to the Clear Channel facility here in Baton Rouge, and we are doing a combined broadcast utilizing, combined from a technical standpoint, utilizing both of our staff of hosts and producers and et cetera. And we're working collectively to get the information back into New Orleans and also across the country via the World Wide Web.
Yeah, and we have a clip of some of your broadcast going out over the Internet. Here a caller is questioning a rumor he heard. We're going to listen to that now.
There's rumor in Hammond that buses are coming out of New Orleans and just dropping refugees off. Now, I've seen a bus unload some, but they loaded them back up and then went to a point. So I don't know if there's some information you can quell this rumor or if that isn't true fact. I'm assuming a bus coming out of New Orleans has a specific destination to take people.
Now, I will tell you, and I was in Hammond yesterday, actually, and I will tell you what I have seen, not only in Hammond but here in Baton Rouge. You do have buses that are taking refugee families to, say, the Walmart or Kmart or wherever. They let them out, let them do whatever the business they're going to do, but then they do get back on the bus, and they go to wherever shelter they are located at. They are having problems finding places for all of these people, naturally, but they're not just going to say, okay, guys, here you're at the Walmart, get out.
So, Andy, part of what you're doing is not only spreading information, but you're also combating rumors and misinformation, it sounds like.
Yes, and that's been difficult at times because particularly in the early stages of our broadcast, the information was so sketchy. But we've been putting together a pretty solid network now of sources where we're really able to get the information out in an organized manner. In the very early days, during the storm and its aftermath, the only radio station in New Orleans that was actually on the air that people could hear was the anchor station for our United Radio Network, which WWL. And then we kept that going with a skeleton crew from our downtown location and also across the river at the Jefferson Paris Emergency Management Center. And the combined staff of that phase of the operation may have been seven people at the most, running 24/7.
Yeah. Has anybody slept during all this time?
Recently, we've begun to. I think the best analogy would be like oil rig workers here in the Gulf. It was like, four on and four off.
Yeah.
But we have, so that was the initial phase when it was just WWL, and literally just WWL with the city through the storm and its immediate aftermath. And then our two companies joined forces, and we've been progressively adding staff. And we're at a point now where we're really able to provide pretty comprehensive coverage.
What's your priority now?
Getting information out. I mean, as your guest earlier was alluding to, there is what we call the reverse contraflow. Contraflow is the evacuation out of the city and the redesign of the transportation system to accommodate that. Beginning today at 6 a.m., Jefferson Parish residents, which is predominantly the Metter-Kennery area in northwest New Orleans, are allowed to come back in.
Right, we just heard from somebody there.
Fix on that. But
listen, Andy, we're going to have to go. Unfortunately, the hour is over. But thank you so much, and thanks for all the incredible work that you're doing there, and best of luck to everybody. Andy Hult is the program director for Intercom Radio's WTKL and WLMG. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. From the Cleveland Clinic Heart Center, offering innovative treatments in cardiology, cardiac surgery, and heart disease research, on the web at clevelandclinic.org/heart. And from the University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law, from California's capital, preparing leaders for a changing world. Details at mcgeorge.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
The Labor Day forecast for East Central Illinois, mostly sunny skies with highs in the mid-80s today. Light winds becoming southeast around 10 miles an hour. Mostly clear skies tonight with lows in the upper 50s.